Let's go ahead and begin. First off, let's just kind of warm up to your appearance here in Oregon. You are giving a presentation tonight at 5:30. And what will the focus be of your presentation, Dana?
Pretty much my focus is going to be about how we must really live the legacy of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so while it is great that we get together every year and we celebrate, celebration is one portion of it, but we must actually really live it. And during Dr. King's lifetime, he would have been 89 years old this year. We know that this is also the 50th anniversary of his, and I hate to say the word anniversary, but this is the 50th year where we will recognize his assassination in April of 1968. So this is really, to me, a heavy year for activism. But the major foundation for my speech is one of the quotes of Dr. King when he said that darkness can't drive out darkness, only light can do that. And hate can't drive out hate, only love can do that. So that is going to be the focusing point of my presentation tonight.
When we think about Martin Luther King's legacy and his vision for America, how close or how far, for that matter, would you say America is from that vision today?
In some ways, we're close. I mean, when you look at, you know, the obvious symbol, the election of the first African-American president in 2008 is quite a feat in a country that had never had an African-American or other, you know, president of color. But that is just one symbol. In terms of being far away, we know that the African-American community on average is still steeped in poverty, disproportionate to their numbers in the population. When we look at the prison industrial complex, the same can be said, where we live in a country where there are about 2.2 million folks imprisoned, and by and large, the majority of those people, disproportionate to their numbers in the population, are African-American men, African-American women, our Native American sisters and brothers, and also our Hispanic sisters and brothers. So in that regard, we are far from it. We have almost 50 million people who live in poverty in the United States of America, the most wealthiest country on the face of the earth, and the overwhelming majority of those are children. Women are still not paid dollar for dollar in most instances as a man. So we have many more miles to go in terms of realizing Dr. King's dream.
One of the big anniversaries we're hitting as well, since we're on the topic of anniversaries, mm-hmm. is the one-year anniversary of the Saturday of President Trump's inauguration.
Yes.
And from what we've seen and heard of his administration, whether it's an official event or one of his tweets, what is your assessment of 1 year of President Trump?
Chaos, chaos, and more chaos. I mean, the president certainly could do a lot better, and that's putting it mildly, in how he engages and deals with the crises that face us as a country. And he has been steeped in chaos. I almost believe the president, he thrives when people are in chaos for some reason. And Twitter, certainly social media, could be used as a tool of deep communication in a way that would lift and almost, you know, it could have been used in the same way that President FDR used radio with the fireside chats to inform the citizens, to keep people lifted, to remind them who we are as Americans. But instead, the president uses Twitter to fight folks, to talk against people, to talk about leaders of foreign countries. It's just really petty. I hate to even compare him to a child because I don't want to insult children. But the president certainly is not comporting himself to this moment as if he is the leader of the free world.
One of the first instances I met you when I was working in Ohio had to do with a series of billboards that were appearing in predominantly African-American and Latino neighborhoods in Ohio, Wisconsin, I believe a few other states.
In 2012.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And is voter suppression still an issue today? Are the billboards still appearing? Are there still concerns that people of color may be intimidated or turned away from the polls? How do you see the situation having changed, if at all, in those last 6 years?
Yeah, I mean, the billboards certainly have not appeared. We know that there was a big push by Republicans to do everything that they could to make President Obama a one-term president. You know, Senator McConnell made that declaration that that is what they were going to do. And so what was happening in 2012, as you know, were targeted areas across the country in key states, but in communities where you knew the overwhelming majority of the population was African American. So although the billboards are not still there, you know, when I think about Shelby v. Holder, you know, the Supreme Court decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act, and you look at states like North Carolina, and thank God we have a breakthrough in North Carolina because a court did declare that the way they drew those lines were manipulative and they were drawn in a way to stop the African-American community from being able to have voice through the ballot box. But hundreds of anti-voter suppression bills across the country, even in my home state, our home state of Ohio, still had that kind of chilling effect. And while we have some in the Republican Party who want to create this boogeyman of folks who impersonate other folks when they go to the ballot box, we know that the Brennan Center has said that the likelihood of having in-person voter impersonation is as strong as being struck by lightning. It's very rare. So yes, is it still going on? Are policymakers still using their power to try to thwart the voting block of poor people, of people of color, of young people? Absolutely they are. And we have to focus locally on the state level and also nationally to bring back the strength, because no matter who you are in this country, one of the greatest equalizers that we have is the whole notion of one woman, one man, one vote. And those of us who have run for office, those of us who hold public office, regardless of our political affiliation, should be incensed by anybody, should be outraged by anybody that would dare to try to thwart that or make it harder for any group to be able to exercise that very fundamental right in this country. So we have lots of work to do.
We're now hearing reports that a lot of elections that are either just happened or are on the horizon are beginning to lean favorably towards Democrats. And of course, this is a buildup to the midterms that are going to be happening this year in November.
Yeah.
Do you think that discontent with President Trump and the Republicans will create an upsurge of support for Democrats and possibly a return of power into at least one congressional house?
There is a strong chance. And although some people are motivated by Mr. Trump's disruption of everything in this country to the negative most of the time, that won't sustain us as a country. And it is my hope that leaders who are running will not just run against Mr. Trump, but run for something. And, you know, I've had, Brian, the opportunity to travel all over this country. Last year, I went to about 12 states in 60 days. And there's a hunger out there, you know, from Tyler, Texas, that is very red, you know, to Columbia, South Carolina, to even, you know, my home state of Ohio. There's a hunger out there that people really just want elected officials to be true to what they say on the campaign trail and use public policy to lift. So whether it's Medicare for All, which we're fighting for nationally, but also fighting for within the states, or it's the $15 an hour minimum wage to lift people out of poverty, making investments in infrastructure, which is good for us as individuals, good for business, just really good for jobs, good for this country, to education. Those are the things that people really care about and to have. And I just want to share one quick story with you. When I was in Louisville, Kentucky, and I met a mother who reached out, you know, after my speech, and she came and she hugged me and she said, "I want to tell you about my son. He was born with a heart condition." And as a mother, I had to deal with the heaviness of wondering whether or not I was going to be able to get health insurance for him. And he's 10 now, but just think about that. You birth a baby into the world. That's a happy time in your life. But as a parent, now you have to deal with whether or not you can have health insurance for your child. And then on the back end, and this is something I had not heard anybody say to me before, she said, "I have to worry about getting life insurance for him." This is the United States of America. No child and no parent should have to worry about whether or not they can have health insurance or whether or not they can have life insurance. So these are the fundamental issues that we must deal with as the United States of America. You talk about making America great again. There are so many ways to make this country great again. And it is my hope that the people who are running fundamentally understand that and know that it is not just enough to point out Mr. Trump's bigotry and short-sightedness, but that we have to run and stand for something. You know, FDR's Economic Bill of Rights comes first to mind from 1941. That is a foundation that we can take and build upon.
There's been an upsurge recently, too, of the Black Lives Matter movement over recent years. dealing with how police forces deal with largely African-American populations in cities and use of force. Another surge has recently happened over recent months, the Me Too movements, mm-hmm. where women have spoken out against sexual harassment, starting yes. in Hollywood and the circles of power in both the film and entertainment industry, and now into politics. Mm-hmm. Do you see Black Lives Matter and Me Too as being crucial parts of the national dialogue moving into the next few elections?
I do. I mean, it's the 21st century version of the Freedom Riders that rode throughout the South to challenge segregation laws on the interstate, very much analogous to the college students that sat down at that Woolworth counter in North Carolina to symbolically put their bodies on the line against that kind of discrimination and racism that wouldn't even allow Black folks to get a hot cup of coffee. So these are 21st centuries of those 20th century movements that galvanized this country and forced us to come face to face with our hypocrisy as a nation. But in these movements, especially the Me Too movement, I don't want us to forget the poor working class women, because it's really, you know, poor people are often left behind. And so it is my hope that as this movement continues, that we don't forget the poor women across this country who have to face sexism every single day. And nobody talks about their struggles. And there are not many women. I mean, I face, you know, sexual harassment. Most of the women I know have. That has just become par for the course in this country. But we do have an opportunity to speak that truth to power and to force those who have the power to change the way we do business in this country in every sector, from Hollywood to the pulpit.
I'm guessing, and let me know if I'm on the mark here, Nina, that when you talk about the plight of poor working class women in the vein of the Me Too movement, you're talking about women who not only face sexual harassment and discrimination, perhaps, but also do so at the loss of maybe losing a promotion, losing their jobs,
That's right.
being cut back with hours. So it sounds like they're kind of in an especially tight bind.
They really are, right? And who speaks up for them? Oftentimes, you know, it is the women or the people who have the highest, you know, cachet, if you will, who get that attention. But the woman that may be working, you know, at a restaurant or at a department store, they don't get, or a woman just working at a company every single day, they don't get the same level of attention as our sisters in Hollywood do. And so this movement must not just be for the upper echelons. This is not just about Harvey Weinstein. This is also about the type of sexual harassment that women face every single day. And they're just trying to hold on to their jobs so that they can take care of their families. And when you couple that with the fact that we still have wage discrimination in this country, you know, we have lots of work to do. And, you know, there's an African proverb that says that many, many hands make for light work. And if conscious-minded people all over this country decide that we're going to fight against bigotry and sexism and discrimination, just all of the isms, if we decide that we're going to come together and really use the legacy of Dr. King's dream to catapult this nation to the next level, there's really nothing that we cannot do.
I don't know if you're familiar much with Oregon history to provide any comments on this, but Oregon was initially founded as a whites-only utopia. There had been a state constitution drafted and enacted that prohibited blacks from living, working, and owning property here until 1926. So we think about racism as a deep South kind of thing, mm-hmm. but I don't know if you had heard of that history here in Oregon, and two, if you had any response to that.
A little bit. I mean, Greg Evans, and he's responsible for me being here, he told me a little bit about that history. And, you know, even in places like Ohio, the same thing, you know, where people saw the North as a bastion of hope, which, you know, it wasn't as overtly racist as maybe the South. But places like Eugene, Oregon, places like Cincinnati, Ohio, some places in Ohio treated African Americans like second class citizens, just as they did in the Deep South. So Oregon has come a long way, I would imagine. But still, we have to remember that institutional racism can only be dealt with in institutional ways, meaning that we need the levers of government to say that we, not on our watch, will we stand for that. We need institutions, both public and private sectors, to say, not under our watch, will we allow any type of bigotry and discrimination to happen? So, yeah, it was an eye opener to hear that that happened in Eugene, Oregon. By law, you know, and that's where the institution, because right, so oftentimes people just, especially in the era of social media, it's just easy to call somebody a racist. Oh, this person's a racist. People can be bigoted and people can discriminate. But the type of racism that Dr. King was working to eradicate, to eliminate, to bring people together, it wasn't just a casual, I don't like you because you're black or because you're brown or because you're a woman. He was talking about institutions. You know, Montgomery bus boycott, for example, in 19, that was about an institution that readily took black people's money. The majority of the folks that rode the buses at that time were African Americans, but they had to enter through the back door. You know, they put their money in, they were relegated to the back of the bus, and the more whites got on the bus, the further back they had to go till at some point they even had to stand up. That's not just about an individual, that was about an institution. It was about the laws in Montgomery, Alabama, that allowed that to happen. And so again, it is easy to point out the transgressions of Mr. Trump, and they are many. But what is harder to deal with is working on the institutions that create environments that keep people oppressed and suppressed. And that is all of our responsibility. It is not just, should not just be laid on the backs of black folks or brown folks to do this. It is everybody. It is the rainbow mosaic of humanity that must deal with this.
You gained some notoriety a few years back when campaign 2016 was really picking up, and that was when you decided that you're going to shift your support from Hillary Clinton to Bernie Sanders. And I'm just curious to know, in the aftermath that followed, do you get heat from people who see you as maybe someone who could have helped steer the tide and prevented a Trump presidency?
Oh, good Lord, Brian, all the time. You talk about hate. I mean, just going to social media where some of the most vicious, vile things are said and done to people just because folks can remain anonymous. You know, Democrats have to look themselves in the mirror and really decide, you know, what really happened in 2016. 2016 was a change election. It was an election that was really against establishment. And the fact that someone like Mr. Trump could be the president of the United States of America should cause all of us pause. I do believe in this country that people have choice. And my choice to support Senator Bernie Sanders was from this deep recognition that this man has been consistent his entire political career, being for issues even when they're not popular, standing up for the forgotten men and women of this country. So whether it's pushing for Medicare for all or fighting for free colleges and universities so that nobody's child is left behind, he has been consistent in that. And it really was his authenticity and what I call his heart-soul agreement, really in the tradition of Dr. Martin Luther King, where I knew I had to support Senator Sanders. So even though I still catch hell even to this moment about my support for him, I would do it again. And the kind of transformation that he has caused in this country, even though he did not win that primary, this country will never, ever be the same because Senator Sanders decided to run. And I believe that the organization right now that I am leading is very much in the spirit and tradition of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. pushing back on establishment folks, whether they be Democrats or Republicans, and asking this country, really, what are we made of? What do we stand for? And that's what Dr. King was challenging his entire civil rights career, but particularly towards those last years that he or nobody else knew would be last. He was assassinated and just taken out by hate. But I believe that if Dr. King was still alive, he would be for Medicare for all. He talked about, of all the injustices in this country, that inequity within the healthcare system is one of the worst. You know, he talked about those things. He talked about poverty and how we were spending all of this money on wars, i.e. the Vietnam War, but not taking care of what was happening in the United States of America. When he went to the ghettos of the North, he was surprised at the squalor and the suffocation of what poverty would do to the minds of the people who had to deal with that. And so while in the South we were dealing with overt racism, Dr. King came to understand that covert racism in the North was just as deadly as what was happening in the South. And that's why he went to Memphis, you remember, and was there to protest along and support the sanitation workers, you know, that the galvanize, he helped to galvanize the poor people's movement again of poor blacks and browns and whites in this country. So Senator Bernie Sanders changed, he changed the game in very positive ways, and I am proud to have supported his candidacy for president in 2016.
And that brings us to 2020. Are you hearing any mutterings of a possible Phil the Burn resurgence in a few years?
Well, he might. I hope that he does. I know the senator has gone on the record whenever he's asked this question, and he has said that he's not ruling it out. So I do hope that Senator Bernie Sanders will make another run at this in 2020.
Another prominent name that's been tossed around quite frequently in the last couple of weeks is Oprah Winfrey, who gave a very stirring speech at the Golden Globes. And do you have any thoughts as to a possible run by Oprah for the same office?
She might. You know, listen, this is America and everybody has the right to run. I certainly wish in 2016 that the Democrats had have had a more robust group of folks running. You know, we had very few. I think Governor Lincoln Chafee was in the race for a time. Governor O'Malley was in the race. And certainly we had Secretary Clinton and Senator Sanders. Meanwhile, on the Republican side, there are about 17 people running. We had diversity. We had women. We had people of color, you know, African-American and people of Hispanic descent. But we did not have that on the Democratic side. So in 2020, who knows? There might be a whole rainbow mosaic of folks running. And to me, the more people who run, the greater opportunity that we will have to have the debates that are necessary. We'll have these conversations that are necessary, and we will clearly understand where people stand. Are they on the side of the working class and the middle class in this country? Or are they on the side of the establishment? So I'm hoping that there are other folks who run, and certainly if Oprah, who has definitely changed the game in her field, in her industry, all over the world, you know, people know who Oprah Winfrey is. If she decides to run, you know, that's fine.